Hi, I'm Cameron Wilson. This is Bush Telegraph. You're on RN and Radio Australia. Ahead today, we're going to tell you all about an international plan to build robots that replicate an Australian sheepdog named Rosie.
So my colleague, Andrew King, he was on British Radio 2 and he got like a mouthful of abuse from a shepherd, basically. He said, "You'll never replace my sheepdog. Why are you wasting taxpayers' money on all of this sort of stuff?"
Why robo working dogs are worth investing in. That's coming up today on Bush Telegraph. We'll also tell you why it's important to keep your garden healthy during times of drought. We'll take you to Queensland for that story. That and more coming up on Bush Telegraph. So this might be a bit of a stretch, but I'll ask you to try anyway. Imagine if the mining industry, farmers and conservationists joined forces today and they all agreed on how to manage, say, coal seam gas expansion throughout the country. Or imagine what a breakthrough it would be if scientists and coal miners agreed on how best to protect the Great Barrier Reef. Seems a little hard to think that it could happen in the current climate. But 25 years ago, one of the big environmental flashpoints in this country was the tensions that existed between farmers and conservationists. Then, along came something called land care, and it brought them both together. Dr. Stefan Hajkowicz is a Futures Principal Scientist at the CSIRO. Hi, Stefan.
Hi, how are you going?
Good, thanks. And Dr. Charlie Brennan is also with me. He's a social ecologist and active land care member. Charlie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Cameron.
Both are speaking at a land care conference later this week, which is marking the group's 25th birthday. Stefan, I know you deal with the future mainly, but just look back for me to begin with. What do you think a group like Landcare has achieved over the last 25 years?
I think it's been a profound set of achievements. So I first got involved in Landcare during my PhD when I went around Queensland working with Landcare groups and examining how they were making decisions. But it was a huge shift from where we were before the year 1990. It was a realisation that natural resource management issues mattered on land, and it was associated with the injection of new funding, effort, activity, but also a globally unique movement that started to put the sustainability issues on the agenda, which just grew and grew from that point.
Globally unique?
At the time it was introduced, there wasn't too much that paralleled Landcare. Different programs existed around the world, but Landcare wasn't just the government going out there and buying stuff. It was a social movement as well. It was a changing ethos and perspective as much as sort of on-ground work. It was on-ground work and practical stuff combined with a new way of thinking about how we manage landscapes. And I remember when I first started researching it, I couldn't really see a clear, similar thing that was happening everywhere in the world. I think it was unique.
Charlie, you've been involved with the movement for a long time. Would you agree it was as radical as Stefan suggests?
Yes, I think it was radical. To me, it was an example of putting some 1970s kind of inspirations and ideas and ideals into practice, and it was radical in that it was genuinely community-based. It was radical in that it went beyond talk. It went to real outcomes. It reached into people, into communities, places, and into the Australian psyche and identity.
And so would you say it was a social movement as much as it was an environmental movement?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, I think it's reached into many communities. It's probably engaged hundreds of thousands of people in Australia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And has it been taken around the world? Have we seen a similar model spread?
Yes, I believe it's something. It's interesting how many of these sustainability practices actually have originated in Australia, even though there's a global movement. But yes, I believe it's moved into several other countries, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So this week you're marking its 25th birthday, but it very much this week is about also seeing how such a movement can adapt and stay relevant in the years ahead. Before we delve into that, Stefan, you deal with predicting trends in the future. That's what you're good at. What are the major trends that will affect agriculture in the next 25 years?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of big ones. I just listened to the short there about the robotic dog, sheepdog that's coming up, but I do think technology changes the way agriculture's done a whole lot. Agricultural robotics, artificial intelligence, but also business systems and business processes with information technology start to shift. But one that's caught my attention a lot lately and that I'm reading along and it's hard to miss is the incredible wealth growth in Asia. As people's incomes rise, they diversify their diets, and we're seeing this massive westernisation of Asian diets that resemble Australian diets a lot more. They're getting also a lot more choosy about what they eat, and I think why it matters for Landcare is that the sustainability, ethical, clean, green, healthy aspect of the food people consume gets a whole lot more important. So as incomes rise in Asia, and probably about 1.02 billion people cross the income threshold from being poor to middle income across the Asia region, they get a whole lot more choosy, and the sustainability dimension of the food they consume gets more important.
So we get richer, we demand sustainable food.
Mm. I think, in a nutshell, I think that's sort of what will happen, to at least to a greater extent.
Can you give me a simple definition of sustainable agriculture?
Yeah, that's a tough one, in that I do remember spending many weeks trying to answer this and giving up early in my PhD.
Depends who you ask, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does depend who you ask. I kind of gave up trying to define sustainability. You kind of know what it is when you see it. It's basically agriculture that does not harm the environment, improves, but it has a long-term and long-lasting benefit that's there. But it, under the broad banner of sustainability, we see ethics, we see social responsibility, we see healthiness, I think, is part of it. It captures a lot, which it gives a strong message to a discerning food customer.
Charlie, we recently spoke to a New South Wales farmer who didn't even like the term sustainable agriculture, preferred regenerative agriculture, suggesting that if you do things right, I guess you embrace the principles of Landcare, you can improve the environment, not just farm sustainably.
Yep.
Yeah, you agree with that?
Sure. There has to be an acceptance of a range of ways of people putting their desire for sustainable outcomes into different forms of expression, whether it be farming, gardening, edible streetscapes, Landcare, regenerative practices.
Mm. Yeah. So, Stefan, when you talk about the rise of the middle class and the change in the types of food that they will demand, is it really environmental concerns that will drive or dictate the decisions, or is some of this around food safety as well?
I think it's a mix. It'll be both. Food safety is a huge one. And I think we saw with China's massive growth in imports of dairy products following the melamine milk scares of the sort of 2008 period, and how the dairy company Fonterra in New Zealand responded so well with a clean, fresh, healthy product that really connected to that market in a big way. Food health and safety are big issues for food consumers across the Asia region, and that's why where Australia can differentiate. But it is connected to ethics and environment to a large extent. Those sorts of things mingle in the customer's mind when they make decisions on what to purchase. And when they're budget empowered, they get to care about these things more.
So does food produced in a healthy environment, is it necessarily the product of that system is safe food as well?
I think it contributes to safe food. A healthy, transparent environment is likely to be associated with those sorts of outcomes better, at least in the mind of the consumer. So, the drivers will be health, safety, freshness, quality of the food, but also the thinking about was this ethically produced and did it damage the environment along the way? I think all of it will mingle and be quite a powerful cocktail for the consumer.
Stefan, stay with us. We might just try to get you back on a new phone line. We're just having a little trouble hearing you. You're there. Stefan Hajkovic is with the CSIRO, speaking at the Futures Principle Scientist with the CSIRO, speaking at the Landcare Conference this week. Also with me is Dr. Charlie Brennan. Charlie, let's just try to explain for people that aren't aware what it is that Landcare actually does. Can you explain your involvement over the years at a local level for me?
Sure. So 25 years of the Landcare movement here in Australia, for me, is almost 20 years of involvement in one particular project, almost to the day. It's the regeneration of Cemetery Creek in Bellingen, and I've been working with Bellingen Urban Landcare for all that time. At a local level, so Bellingen, for anyone who doesn't know it, is kind of a bit of a sustainability town. It's a town that people go to try and put their sustainability kind of desires into practice in various ways. And myself and some other people back in 20 years ago, decided that we would go beyond the rhetoric and start actually working on the local creek. And it was since then, it's involved thousands of people. It's involved $1 million of funding. It's involved 50,000 hours of labour. It's involved all sorts of groups of people from the local community. And if I was able to show you images now, I'd be able to show you how befores and afters and how quite degraded creek areas have now become beautiful bits of regenerated riparian rainforest.
So what a project like that, what's it been its big achievement? I guess obviously the restoration of the riparian area along the creek, but what else?
It all depends on what you're measuring, what you're looking for. So ecologically, fantastic outcomes. Areas of ecology have been connected. Threatened species have been given habitat. People have gotten jobs out of it. People have made friends out of it. Community has become prouder of its landscape. Local parks and markets are places people want to go to. The people who have worked on those projects often have got a deep sense of therapy, if you like. There's such a thing as therapeutic horticulture and sense of place out of it.
So you'll distinguish the social benefits versus the environmental benefits?
I wouldn't create any kind of dichotomy. They all run together. Mm. Yes.
We've got Stefan back with us now. Stefan, to come back to your point earlier about all the question we were posing about what is sustainable agriculture and what people are actually going to demand in the future with more income to spend around this area, does sustainable agriculture have to look like an old-fashioned model? Outdoor farming, green hills, pre-industrial agriculture?
Not necessarily. No, I think information technology is going to change the way agriculture is done, and hopefully, you know, in a positive way, it can create a lot of efficiencies. I think one part of the way it comes is via highly advanced food supply chains. So imagine being in the supermarket and swiping your iPhone over the tomatoes, and it gives you an instant picture of where they were grown. It tells you about what was done to create those tomatoes. And if you want, you're able to click on the icon of the farmer and have a quick chat to him and find out a bit about what he's done in the production of the product. I think, but if behind that mental image is a whole lot of sensory systems, information technology that has the farm to fork supply chain is mapped in there, and that starts to change the way markets can operate. So I reckon technology will reshape food supply chains, and there's a space there for product differentiation.
But couldn't technology reshape the production system in a very different way? If I think of some of the examples of technology that we've covered on this program, you could see, let's just take eggs as an example, you could see a system of intensive egg production where the fuel is all for the shed, all comes from waste from the chooks, it's all a closed system, they're fed on protein pellets from factory farmed maggots, and it's a totally... you could make an argument it's a totally sustainable system, yet it wouldn't look like the sort of thing someone would want to swipe their iPhone over and look inside.
Yeah, maybe. I think technology does create the possibility of food production systems, but the consumer will care a lot about whether or not the eggs are free range. I mean, it's obvious to anyone who goes into a supermarket today and buys eggs. They're mostly free range, so it is something that matters to the consumer about how the food was produced, I think. But I do believe that technology and robotics, artificial intelligence, will find their way out of the factory and into the real world and will influence agriculture with robotics. I'm sure you'll have heard about fruit picking devices that can be done robotically. I saw a vine pruning system in New Zealand which trims a vine 90% better than a human being. Those sorts of things will find their way into agriculture with cost cutting.
But can these consumer preferences, the sort of things that might emotionally make us feel better, feel like we're doing something about the environment, can they actually lead to perverse outcomes? You end up with a system that is more detrimental?
I think that's an interesting one. I think the some of the controlled systems that you talk about may actually be more efficient, but it's not just environmentally efficient in terms of how much water and energy. It's also, you know, animal welfare is probably part of it, and also the whole production system.
Yeah, but we're looking at a future where there is a potentially a shortage of arable land, you've got free range systems that take up more land, take up more water, potentially have slower growing animals. There is an environmental argument against those systems, isn't there?
Could be in some cases. I think the controlled production systems may work better. Perhaps synthetic products are something that starts to get onto the agenda to a great extent in the future. For example, synthetic clothing instead of cotton and wool. That's an issue. Or even synthetic meats, maybe we see happen. I understand in London they've had the first taste test of fully lab-grown meat, and it came up okay.
So gets us a long way from our starting point of how Landcare fits in with the future model, I guess. Maybe
I mean, I don't buy into necessarily that high-tech model. I don't know that it has to go that way. I think that I would... You know, I still would like to know when I swipe my iPhone over the tomatoes, I'd like to see the big countryside patch and talk to the farmer. And I think I don't have enough information to say how consumers in general respond, but my feeling is that will be part of it, that over centuries humans have got used to certain ways of eating and making food, and we won't just abandon them overnight.
Yeah, there's something in our makeup that wants to know the person and the human system behind the... or the biological system behind the food we eat. If I asked you to assess how the conflict between agriculture and the environment or environmentalists has changed over the past 25 years, how would you assess that?
Look, if I had a shot at that, I'd say that movements like Landcare have drawn those together, and so that we know the long-term agricultural productivity of soil and profitability has been linked to some of the environmental goods. So we've removed a lot of the conflict that used to exist. Now, it's not to say it's all gone. There will still be areas of conflict between any industry and environmental outcomes. There's a lot of production processes that are associated with pollution. But I think what we've seen in agriculture and what Landcare did that was so special was it started to say, hey, there's a whole lot of stuff that matters for the environment, but it matters for the long-term productivity of the farm. And that kind of came together. So the areas of conflict on these two overlapping Venn circles, that's how I think about it, has been reduced.
Charlie Brennan, how do you think that level of conflict has changed over the last 25 years?
Yeah. Well, if you work in conservation on the ground, at the community level, it's something you can come across from time to time. But my experience of working with Urban Landcare and now with as a regional coordinator for the Great Eastern Ranges Initiative is that when different groups of people, different people with different positions, different interests around the environment, when they work together on projects, when they actually start putting things into action, they nearly always come together.
Yep. You're hearing here from Dr. Charlie Brennan, social ecologist and a member of Landcare, and also Dr. Stefan Hajkowicz, CSIRO Futures Principles Scientist. And we're discussing the future of the Landcare movement. It was a radical concept when it started 25 years ago, bringing conservationists and farmers together to address issues like salinity and plant more trees. It's now celebrating 25 years, so we're looking at what the future holds for this group, for this movement. Charlie, given what Stefan has said, the future he sees, more people with more money to spend on products that they see produced in an environmentally sustainable way, what opportunities does that open up for Landcare to adapt and change and remain a relevant organisation?
Well, I think Landcare does need to change. It's 25 years old now, and as much as we need to celebrate all the good things that happened under Landcare, and it's been radical, it's been profound for many people, things have changed. There are some issues with Landcare. For instance, a lot of people who entered Landcare in the first place are pretty much sitting on the same committees a lot of the time, so it's kind of aged a little. Younger people tend to go into other kinds of ways of expressing their desire for sustainability.
I'd argue you could walk down the main street of Sydney or Brisbane, ask a lot of people what Landcare is, and you'd get a blank look.
Right.
Do you think that's harsh? Do you think that's
I think
fair?
That's a little harsh.
Yeah?
It depends. I don't know. I live in the country mostly these days. Most people have some idea of what Landcare is, even if it's a myth or an idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. That what they're probably maybe struggling with the actual definition of what happens on the ground.
Yeah. Either way, it goes to your point, though, that you need to bring fresh blood in, recruit younger people to
anything.
Take an interest.
Anything needs innovation. Yeah. So I have a few suggestions as to how Landcare could radically reconstitute itself again. One of them is that I'm also a social scientist, and I believe that Landcare needs to enter into a process of critical reflective practice, as you would as a social scientist or a social ecologist.
Which means what exactly?
It means if you're a social worker, you're trained to think about what you do each day and the implications and how it felt and how it affected other people and so on, whereas ecologists tend not to be so good at that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think as part of that also, it'd be really good to go out and talk to all the on-ground land carers who've often dedicated decades of their lives to Landcare and ask them their experiences. I feel like there's a whole set of social and environmental capital that's not getting acknowledged, and skills and ideas that could be used. I think Landcare needs to be made easier for land carers. There needs to be more assured funding.
When you say land carers, do you mean the volunteers that are involved in land care?
I mean the movement as a whole, which is both professional and voluntary and semi-professional, all sorts of people.
Has that changed, the makeup? I imagine in the beginning it was very much volunteer-based, and as years have gone by and more money's been put into it, perhaps there's an element of bureaucracy that's become involved, and also a level of contractors and professional people that are involved in the projects as well?
Yeah, there has been a shift from, you know, like a lot of new things, a lot of us were experimenting 25 years ago. We didn't really know what we were doing half the time. And then we kind of, a set of skills and practices solidified, crystallized, if you like. And then that led to some jobs of various sorts. And yes, there's been a sort of a drift towards professionalisation of the sector.
Mm-hmm.
But still, you'll find most committees, for instance, are all volunteers, dedicated volunteers. Any working bee, they're nearly all volunteers. So it's still a blend of volunteers and professionals.
Yeah,
I do think, though, that land care could be made easier for people who are... It's a lot of effort to be a land carer. It's not an easy thing to do, okay?
In what sense? Where does the effort come in?
Physical effort of engaging with sites, of weeding places year after year after year, of dealing with floods, of pushing projects along. Like, you can't... Anyone who works with the land knows that you can't just walk away from the land. Once you have a relationship with a land or a project, you need to... It's a committed relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't just walk away, you go back again and again, and it's effort, it's reward, but it's also effort.
You haven't even touched on a big one at the moment, and that's about $500 million in funding that's been lost from the movement. How do you overcome that? That's got to be crippling for some local groups.
I think a lot of local land care groups at the moment are still working on goodwill and remaining funds, and they're concerned about the future. My feeling is, it's not really my area of expertise, but my feeling is that the good thing that land care is can't be ignored for very long. Politics will change and people realise that this is something to back.
Mm. So the land care itself that loses the money, and that money has essentially been shifted into the Green Army, how will that change the nature of the, in your view, the nature of the, one, the projects that are done, and also the social outcomes as a result?
There's a concern that the social and ecological capital that's been built up will just drift away and be lost to the community. People will disengage from land care because it's too hard. I would argue too, having had some experience of GreenCorps in the past, and that was a fantastic program overall, I think, that you need strong land care groups to deliver things like Green Army. If you don't have good funding for your community land care groups and project managers who can work alongside something like the Green Army, I can foresee them. It might struggle.
Mm. Yep. So, if you've pointed out that you've struggled to recruit new people since the beginnings, the 89, early 90s.
Mm.
I wonder why you think that's the case. If you look around, do you feel that there's an interest in sustainable living, that there's an appetite to be involved in this kind of work, or there's a basic feeling, an underlying feeling in the community that this sort of work matters?
Oh, absolutely. There's a one of my favourite quotes here is from someone called Taylor, and he points out that there are tens of millions of people around the world right now working for environmental change. Tens of millions of people committed will do almost anything for environmental change, so I don't doubt that there's plenty of commitment for environmental care. How that is expressed may not just be through land care, it may be through community gardens or health practices, or it can be expressed a variety of ways, and it's important that that's okay. But I do think land care needs a little bit of a shake-up. This reflective practice is really important. I think the acknowledgement of experiences, I think funding, and also one of the big things about land care is the difficulty in refunding projects. If you've got a fantastic project, it ought to be rewarded. There should be some funding for rewarding excellence. Would be
so
a really good thing to do.
In the present system, is it easier to get money for something new?
New project, correct.
Yeah. Sort of the way the world works a bit sometimes, isn't
it?
It
is.
It's not just land care.
I think also land care needs to widen its scope. Land caring isn't just about biodiversity. It needs to take on these other expressions of sustainability, looking after the land. It also needs to be conscious of being socially inclusive as well.
Has it not been at times?
I think it can do better, probably.
Mm.
Yeah.
What do you mean by widen its expression?
So why not think of land care as also being community gardens or edible landscapes or renewable energy or sustainable housing as well? We tend to think of it in a certain narrow way. Now, if we're thinking about throwing some ideas around, this is one thing. It's no point saying people aren't coming to land care when actually they're caring for the land in a different way.
Okay, so people's interest in renewable energy leads them to their local land care group rather than just their interest in restoring a riverbank somewhere.
Well, if we're throwing ideas around, why not?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Right, Stefano, this is the challenge, I guess, isn't it? How does a group like Landcare harness, if we accept there is this community interest in sustainable living out there, how does it harness that interest and get more members, more work done, remain relevant?
Yeah, look, I think it's a big challenge for Landcare, and I think there's an aspect where Landcare needs to make itself sexy again and attractive to a lot of people to get into doing it. So it may be slipping there. And I also have always felt with Landcare when I was involved in it, it shouldn't just be about rural areas, it should also be about cities and urban stuff. So that me as an inner city person who lives in Brisbane can feel like they're part of Landcare as well as the people living in country areas. Mm. So that it can continue, and that that's the reality of how the job market shifts. I also had a sort of theory and idea about Landcare when I was younger, that it would grow to the point where it would have a business model associated with it, where some of what it was providing and doing was changing the way food markets operate. And I think there is still that prospect for Landcare.
So what, it's not at the mercy of changes in government funding?
That's right. So the consumers buying the products actually care more about Landcare. And this question, I think the challenge raised there, which is a great one around widening the concept of Landcare, I would be putting into it food quality, food health, food safety. But you know, I wonder about whether taking a consumer-oriented perspective of what Landcare is about too, because food markets are big, they're global, and they can drive major change. And much greater dollars are associated with that, and that could influence what Landcare does as well. So it's a bit hard to articulate, but I think that there might be a shift into a consumer-driven model of Landcare as well, or a consumer-influenced model.
So let's stick with just try and get an example of what you're talking about, because I think this is an interesting area to talk about generating money or commercialising this. Stick with the egg example from earlier. Could you potentially have, say, a Landcare community certified producer where the local group that works on the farm restores the environment on the farm basically vouch for the system?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Landcare can fill that role in the supply chain. I mean, if there's a whole lot of eggs in the supermarket and half of them are all caged eggs and unhappy-looking chickens, and then the other half have got pictures of the countryside and chickens walking around, but it's not just pictures, it's also married by some real evidence and information associated with the Landcare movement. A lot of consumers will go in the direction of the happy chicken eggs, which are associated with sustainability. And the way consumers think about this sort of stuff is very fuzzy, but those are the vital decisions and choices that we want to influence, because there are millions of those choices being made every day that can put resources in the way of better managed landscapes. So there might be something in there for Landcare about thinking about what is it that the consumer is buying when they buy food, and what does Landcare do as part of that decision-making framework. But then I think there's still a whole lot more of Landcare which is not captured fully by that too.
Mm. Charlie, last one to you. You've got 20 years experience in working with the movement. Are people that volunteer their time that are tied up with Landcare ready? Would they be accepting of such a change?
For sure. Some would and some wouldn't. I think Landcare needs to be... My final point would be that we're living in an age now of hyper-connectivity, and Landcare needs to make sure it's connected out in all sorts of ways. It needs to work with this hyper-connected world of people and places and organisations, and in particular work with organisations like the Great Eastern Ranges, which is about cross-sector collaborations, whole of landscape management. So, yes, get these local places strong and environmentally sound, but also connect out.
Okay, yep. Well, if we stay relevant, we'll be here in 25 years to ask you how you got on.
Great.
Thanks, Charlie. Thanks for coming in.
Thank
Dr.
you.
Charlie Brennan, social ecologist and active Landcare member. And Stefan, thanks for joining us today as well. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. See you.
Dr. Stefan Hajkowicz, who's CSIRO Futures Principal Scientist. This is Bush Telegraph on RN. While we're pondering what the future of land management and farming will look like, we will tell you more about this proposed robotic sheepdog. later in the program that has been dubbed by one of our members here at the ABC as Bar2D2. So we'll tell you exactly how it will work a little later. First, though, Tony Allen's got today's rural news. Tony, where should we start? How about the NFF? They've got a big sponsorship deal with Coles Supermarkets that's ruffled a few feathers.
Yeah, well, the National Farmers Federation annual conference is on next month, and Coles is going to be the main sponsor. Coles also sponsored the NFF Congress in 2012. This year it's going to provide a keynote speaker and have a say in the conference agenda. Now, you will recall that a lot of farmers were very unhappy with Coles when it started its dollar a litre milk price. Chris Gleeson is from Farmer Power, which you might call a farm advocacy group, sort of a splinter group or a rebel group, and he says the NFF's relationship with Coles appears to be a conflict of interest.
They are representing the agriculture sector, and they should be fighting a lot harder and not going into bed with their partners. And, okay, we need some relationship, but if they're going to continue to put downward pressure on the agricultural sector, we don't want to be a part of that.
But the NFF says the sponsorship deal does help improve the relationship between Coles and its suppliers. And for the dairy sector, for example, there has been ongoing discussion and closer relationships in terms of supplying milk and so on. He says it will broaden the understanding of these issues and the relationship between the two parties. Mm. Still, it's pretty interesting.
It's interesting, but I guess whether farmers like it or not, the big supermarkets exist and will continue to be big buyers for... Well, for a little while, yeah, you'd think, wouldn't you? Let's talk cotton, shall we? The harvest is still a fair way off, but there's an outlook for the harvest, Dad. What's expected?
They're about to start planting cotton. Cotton's grown in New South Wales and Queensland, and last year there was a huge crop, 4 million bales, very healthy, but the drought has taken its toll. There's not enough water in the major dams, and the Cotton Australia is predicting national output will drop from 4 million bales last season to about 2 million. Cotton Australia Chief Executive Adam Kay says some areas of New South Wales will only produce about a third of last year's crop.
I would say that the northwest is probably harder hit. You know, places like the border rivers up at Mungindi and the Gwydir, Walgett and Bourke are probably harder hit. They probably have maybe a third the area of last season. And then the Macquarie is going to be probably about a third of last year as well.
Okay, so the harvest is a fair way off. They've got to put it in the ground first. Let's talk water. There's an interesting study out showing the amount of water being used in some communities. What's this telling us?
Look, the Murray-Darling Basin Authority has been keeping tabs of population growth in the basin, other things like the housing market, the water market, what changes are being made to irrigation to help it guide the implementation of the basin plan. And it's basically looking at whether communities are actually coping with the social and economic impacts of less water, the water that has been taken away under the Murray-Darling Plan and given to the environment. Well, the finding is, yes, they are adjusting and they're doing okay. Phil Townsend, the authority's senior economic advisor, says each district seems to be coping differently with recovering from a shortage of water.
The last 3 years have actually been three very different climate years. So people trying to make decisions about what to plant, how much water they're going to either buy in, sell out, and how much they'll carry over. And people are trying to work all this through the basin plan, having recovered water. What does that mean for the amount of supply and demand in the temporary market at different times? People are trying to build a history here and understand what's going on.
Yeah, it does seem that the fears that whole communities would be totally deserted and would be a population desert have not been borne out yet, but that's partly because of an improvement in the weather.
Because it was those fears that fueled some of those demonstrations we all saw in the news at the time, I guess, wasn't it?
Will be interesting to see how the current drought eventually flows through to water storages and so on. As we can see, it's already affecting cotton.
Mm. Okay. All right, if you're interested in that story or any others, you can go to abc.net.au/rural anytime throughout the day.
Last week on Me, Ricky and Him, It's bad poetry. Why would you want to expose our audience to it?
Unthreatening, and there was a lack of warmth.
She tries to make an effort, but sometimes that's just not enough.
The second-rate, talent-free co-host.
It could be another word for dull.
Really looking forward to working with you, Ricky.
Me, Ricky and Him. A radio show about a radio show. Sunday at 3.
Let's keep going on that question Tony just raised about the impact of the drought. For more than a year now, we've been hearing about the enormous toll that the drought in Queensland in particular is taking. We know dams have dried up and livestock have been dying. Where there was pasture or crops, there's now basically bare dirt. One place of solace for people living on farms through drought is often their garden, but the severity of this dry has seen most of those gardens disappear, wiping away years and sometimes generation of nurturing and attention. But, as Chrissy Arthur found, help is on the way.
When we came here, there was one tree in the backyard. The fence round the house was quite small, but I sneaked out through under the fence until I got up to nearly 2 acres of garden. But when the drought came, oh, it hurt, because I could see everything dying. The dam went dry, all our dams went empty. The kangaroos ate all the plants, right down to the roots, and up as high as they could reach. It was just devastating.
Like many women in country Queensland, Gwen Rogers is a passionate gardener. Over more than 50 years, she created a lush oasis around the Glendon homestead, just outside Longreach in the west of the state. But with no water to keep her plants alive, Gwen had to let the garden go. More than three quarters of Queensland is currently drought declared, and the ongoing dry has been heartbreaking for these country green thumbs. But help is at hand for people like Gwen through the Green Thumb Express. This social media initiative encourages people in other areas of the state to pot up a plant or a cutting and send them west to help establish new gardens.
I'm slowly getting little patches of it back again, but it's going to take a long time. It's been my saviour. It's kept me sane. Well, I hope I'm sane. No, it's somewhere you can go out and switch completely off from all your worries. You do your planting, your watering, and you see things coming, and you can walk out and feel peace. It just makes you feel... You ask any gardener, they'll say, it's the peace you feel. And the saying is, you're closer to God in the garden than anywhere else on earth.
The Green Thumbs campaign is the brainchild of Windora grazier Gay Tully. She established a Facebook page earlier this year with almost 1,000 fans, many of whom signed up to be donors, plant collection depot points, or couriers to get the plants to those in need. Gay and her team are at Retreat Station near Junda today, distributing more than 200 plants to local landholders.
The idea came, I guess, when I arrived home one day from mustering and the creek was dry at home, the lawn was dying, and I thought, well, a lot of people had phoned up and said, you know, what can we do to help out in the drought? Because the drought was so very severe, and I thought, well, pot up a plant and send it west. So that's how it all started.
And so where have gardeners helped from in terms of city, coastal? Where have the plants come from?
They've come from the city, they've come from the coast, they've come from around Dalby, Toowoomba, like, they've come from everywhere. But we also have coordinators in a lot of towns like Emerald. We have a coordinator in Croydon up north. So it's gone like all over Queensland.
What do you think of the response?
The response has been absolutely wonderful. Absolutely. It's amazing. So many people want to help. Bush people are a little funny in accepting anything for nothing, I might add. So you've got to give them a bit of a push and say, look, these are here. They've been donated very kindly. Please take them home.
Is the program continuing?
It's winding down a little bit, but it still is continuing. So those that haven't had rain, like there's people further west, and I'd really like to get plants out to them. I have people away that still have plants ready to come west, so I'm just saying to them, hold off until, you know, say further west get rain, and then we can help them out as well.
A special guest at today's Garden Exchange is ABC Radio gardening guru Tom Wyatt. He's been giving garden advice to regional Queenslanders for more than 30 years.
It's only gardeners that create environment, no one else. We can all write airy-fairy reports, can't we, on what should happen to this environment, but go and create it.
people are even surprising themselves with the types of plants that they can grow. I tell people, if you like it, grow it. Just find out where it come from and see if you've got that sort of environment somewhere in your garden and try it. Right now is the beginning of spring. This is the time to take all vegetative cuttings, especially the tip growth of cuttings, and getting the seed in. Now's the time to get the seed in. Get it all ready before summer. This is the time.
And how hard is it to establish a garden in the harsh outback environment?
Well, from what I've seen, it's very easy, isn't it? It makes my mouth water to see these types of gardens out here where you think the environment is very harsh and they've got plants that are growing better here than on the coast.
One of those lining up to get her free plants is Julie Allen. She comes from Tarkham Station near Stonehenge.
The Green Thumb Express, I think, is just amazing. They look to be like plants that will grow here, the tried and true that we know are going to work. People are so kind. You know, we don't want anyone feeling sorry for us. We choose to live here. I think just to show that, you know, it is a bit tough, but we'll get through it and we want to be here. We love the land and we love our animals and we couldn't think of anywhere better to live.
And your gardens.
And the gardens. Love the garden. No, it's very heartening. Very lovely, and we're so, ever so grateful for the little things like that. They really mean a lot to us. We're going through tough times, but it'll get better. It always does. It's always up and down on the land, but to get lovely, things like that, bits of garden, just it's kind of exciting. It's like Christmas. It's awesome.
The importance of a garden in drought. Hey, Chrissy Arthur with that report. You are listening to Bush Telegraph, RN and Radio Australia. I'm Cameron Wilson. I've been promising you this story. You can't imagine that too many farmers would really want to replace their trusted kelpie with a robot, but it's an option that they could actually have in the years ahead, although just when exactly you'll be forced to choose between a border collie or a robo-dog is point of contention at the moment. David Sumter has a better idea about this than most. He's an animal behaviourist with the School of Mathematics at Uppsala University, that's in Sweden. And for the last year, he and his colleagues have been looking at the science behind herding sheep and working out when they could build a robotic sheepdog. He told me more via Skype.
It wasn't that it started with the robotic sheepdog. What it started... So I study collective animal behavior, how animals behave in groups and how they interact with each other. So I was very interested when my colleague went out into the bush in Australia and started studying sheep and sheep interactions. But what really struck us was how the sheepdog was behaving. So the sheep are kind of boring animals. They sort of get in a group. But the sheepdog is very interesting. It has it looks to see where the sheep are and it tries to collect them together. And so we started thinking about what are the rules which this sheepdog uses? How does it manage to get all these sheep to move together?
Spoken like a mathematician, there must be rules, eh?
Yeah, we had to find out the rules. And we looked, and we had a look in the engineering literature, and engineers are very interested in this problem. They want to collect up objects of various types. How do they design something to do that? And what they'd done is they decided to build these algorithms, or their algorithms were based on a zigzag motion of the sheepdog behind the sheep, or the thing that's collecting behind the sheep. And what we wanted to know was, why does this zigzag motion come about? And we found that the dog does two things. Sometimes, if it sees the sheep are spreading out too much, it runs to the side and gets them together in a group again. But then it tries to drive the sheep forward. So there's these two stages, drive and collect. And doing those together leads to this zigzag motion.
So there is a formula behind this behaviour of a sheepdog, is it?
Yeah, we think there is a formula. So what we were able to do is we put GPS on all the sheep, we put GPS on the sheepdog, and we could see what they were up to. We could plot it all out on a computer, and then we could try and mimic that algorithm inside the computer. And one of my PhD students, Daniel Strombom, he built up exactly this algorithm and could reproduce the sheepdog behavior. And we checked it against the real sheepdog, and it seemed to work out.
Now, there was one sheepdog in particular, I think, that got your attention in an Australian, South Australian sheepdog called Rosie. What can you tell me about Rosie?
Well, she's very good at, like, rounding up sheep. So you don't need to... If you've seen sheepdog trials on the TV or so on, what they often do is they're saying... like they're giving a lot of orders to the sheepdog. You know, you have to move to the left, move to the right, take the sheep here and take the... But you don't have to do that with Rosie. You just have to say, bring them in. And she goes in and she goes out and collects in the sheep herself. So she can do everything herself. And so I think that's not all sheepdog can manage to do this. So that's quite a talent.
So it was Rosie's movements are in part responsible for the development of this algorithm, are they?
Oh, yes. So everything is based on... we only have this one sheepdog observation, actually, because it takes a lot of time to put all these GPS on it. So everything we know about sheepdogs at this point is based on her behaviour.
I wonder how farmers or dog trainers, people that work with dogs generally, have reacted to this idea that that you can replicate what a dog does with a simple formula, or maybe not so simple, but a formula.
Unfortunately, they haven't been too positive about it. So my colleague, Andrew King, he was on British Radio 2, and he got like a mouthful of abuse from a shepherd, basically. He said, "You'll never replace my sheepdog. Why are you wasting taxpayers' money on all of this sort of stuff?" And you know, so I understand that feeling. We can't actually reproduce. Sheepdogs are a lot cleverer than we've worked out so far. We don't know everything about sheepdogs, so I do understand that point of view. But what we're trying to do is find out the basic rules of how groups interact, and that can be useful in all sorts of other applications. For example, just now I'm working on a project with race organizers at marathons, and what they're interested in is the flow of people. How do people move around, and how can we make a good race organization? Where should we place the bins, for example? And so we can use the same techniques as we use for modeling sheep and sheepdogs to try and describe the behavior of people moving through an area. The same thing you can think about at rock concerts and so on. If you want to empty out a rock concert, what's the best way of designing an area? And maybe you could even think about some sort of robots which help people get out of rock concerts at the end of a concert.
So you're not at all trying to replace the living, breathing sheepdog with a robotic version of the sheepdog. You're taking what you learn from the sheepdog to apply it to busy, crowded situations of humans, are you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I don't think it's worth, well, certainly financially it's not worth trying to replace the sheepdog. You can imagine how much it would cost to build an entire robot to replace that. But what we're trying to do is understand the basic rules of interaction between animals, between humans, between sheep and sheepdogs. And the more information we get about that, the better we are at building models of those types of situations.
But why look at the interaction between sheep and a sheepdog for this information, rather than just monitor the crowds at a rock concert or a marathon or whatever the event is that you're trying to regulate the flow of people?
Yeah, right. Well, we do that too, of course. I mean, for the it's not like for this marathon, we don't just immediately say, well, they're all sheep. They move in a different way. But the point is, for me, I work in the maths department, and what we're building up is a set of tools to deal with all of these types of different problems. So the sheepdog is one problem, but the tools that we use and the tools we develop can be used in other situations as well.
Mm-hmm. So could you have picked other animal interactions? Was it particularly the sheepdog and the sheep that was of interest?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And that's what we do. So I work on sheep, I work on fish and ants and birds, and we're doing different ways. We track them with video cameras sometimes. We put GPS on these animals. We work with a whole range of different animals trying to understand their interactions. So I'm in a really lucky position in my job because I get to work with all these excited biologists who have their favorite study system, like Andy worked out with the sheep in Australia. But other people come with data they've collected on fish where we film them in a tank. Other people come with GPS data on pigeons. And we try and put all of this information together, basically to find this underlying algorithm.
Okay, so it's not even restricted to agricultural animals. It's anything and everything, by the sounds of it.
It's anything and everything. I'm basically interested in how groups behave, and those groups can include humans as well. So it's trying to understand the basics of group behavior.
So if I just make sure I understand this correctly, you'll take the formula, the mathematical equation that you've come up with from monitoring Rosie the sheepdog in South Australia, potentially apply that to a robot-like structure that will then mimic those movements to round up people in any given event. Is that the possible application?
That's exactly the possible application. I suppose I'm emphasising two things. So we could start to think about applications of exactly this sheepdog algorithm. And I think rounding up people in an escape situation, something like that, is a possible application. But the other thing is this underlying basic knowledge that we get. The more that we understand about interactions of anything, the better we are at building better arenas where people flow through them better race courses where people can run through them better. It's the underlying knowledge that you get from studying these types of systems which can be applied in a whole range of different areas.
So you made the point earlier that clearly people aren't sheep, but it sounds like we can be forced to, or at least encouraged, to behave like sheep if we're prodded in the right direction.
Yeah, I think so. I think I don't want to go on the radio and say we're all like sheep, but certain situations we do a lot of herding behavior. You know, if we've all stood in queues, for example, which turn out to be queues for nothing. You know, oh, there's a load of people standing over there, I'm going to go over there and stand and see what they're waiting for. So a lot of our reactions in our everyday movements are a herding behavior. And we can use that to better understand how we should plan our environments.
I guess we've all seen that sometimes the stampedes at religious festivals that end with horrible consequences, and another example, I guess. So where are we at then? How long or how likely is it even that we will see this development put into action, that you will see robots based on sheepdog movements in the future?
Yeah, I have to say that different people in my field have different views of that. I have to say that I think it's a long, long way off. It's a long way until we could get a sheepdog robot to really work. The problem is that you've got things like getting it to move across the terrain. How are you going to do that? You've got problems with the fact that sometimes these sheepdogs use their eyes to guide the sheep in particular ways. How are you going to reproduce a robot to do that type of thing? So there is sort of a lot of practical problems. Another thing is, so we actually, after we got this criticism, I put up a YouTube video showing how our sheepdog fails sometimes. So our robot doesn't always work, or our simulated sheepdog doesn't always work. And sheepdogs have a bit of common sense, which is very difficult to get in robots. This is the sort of key problem in all of artificial intelligence, is that robots and computers just don't have this common sense aspect that even animals have. So we're still quite a long way off from being able to completely solve this problem.
Yeah, of course. So Rosie's job is done by the sound of it, but I take it Rosie's a Kelpie from what I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're from Border Collie territory, aren't you, originally? So this is a divisive debate in Australia, Kelpie versus Border Collie. I wonder how you fell on the Australian side of the line.
I am afraid I don't have any opinion. I mean, I was on Radio Scotland talking at about the International Sheepdog Show the other day. I'm sure they would be very passionate about their Border Collies there. I'm afraid I can't. I'm not going to make any comment on that.
The arguments you found yourself dragged into, hey? Well, David, really interesting stuff. It's amazing what you can learn from the management on a farm, or, you know, the practice, the skills of a working farm dog. Thank you so much for explaining where you're at.
Thank you very much.
David Sumter, Professor of Applied Mathematics at Uppsala University in Sweden, speaking to me there via Skype. If you're interested in all things working dogs, you might like to listen to and read about our story from last Friday that was basically an assessment on how much influence the owner of a working dog has on the behaviour of that working dog. It was based on a reasonably extensive survey out of the University of Sydney. So you'll find that on the website, the Bush Telegraph page from last Friday. You can listen to the interview or read the article if you prefer. And while you're online, there's a really interesting story up today on the front page of the RN site. We cover renewable energy stories from time to time here on Bush Telegraph. The story that's up today is by Future Tense, and it's an area of renewable energy that we don't discuss terribly often. Artificial photosynthesis, basically taking the sun's energy to create oxygen and hydrogen. So if you're interested in renewable energy, I encourage you to have a look at the RN website and have a listen to that story for yourself. That's it from me for today. I'll see you at the same time tomorrow. Stay on RN. News is for you next, then the World Today.
Choice, the consumer advocates, do a bit more than test vacuum cleaners. They run campaigns too. And Chief Executive Alan Kirkland says they get some pretty big wins.
Within months, you're going to see a simple star rating system on the front of food packages in supermarkets that will make it easier to choose between products.
Choice boss Alan Kirkland. He's on Sunday Profile. Download the program or listen at the RN website.